Hello, everybody, and welcome to New Books in Psychoanalysis. I'm Anna Fishson, your host, and today it's my pleasure to be speaking with Alison Bancroft about her recent book, Fashion and Psychoanalysis, published by Ivy Taurus in 2012. Alison, welcome. It's great to have you on.
Hi, Anna. Thank you for having me.
So Alison is, just to introduce her very briefly, is a London-based academic, researcher and writer specializing in psychoanalytic cultural studies. She has a PhD from Queen Mary, University of London, and has taught at the University of London, the University of the Arts, and the Sorbonne. She's currently lecturing in fashion theory at Arts University Bournemouth.
Bournemouth.
Okay, got it. And is working on her second book, which actually hopefully we'll have time to ask you about it. We'll have a chance to listen to what's going on for her most recently. So before we begin in earnest, I'd like to say something about the structure of the book, just to guide us a little bit. Alison, please feel free to interrupt me as I do this.
Sure, I will do, absolutely.
If I say something like just off. So the book basically puts into conversation psychoanalysis and fashion, asking what one offers the other, and what psychoanalysis and fashion together maybe tell us about the modern subject or modern subjectivity. And there are four kind of large, meaty chapters in the book. The first is about fashion photography, mostly about Nick Knight. And we'll hear more about him, of course, but he did a series of photographs, maybe some of you know, of athletes, models, artists with disabilities, missing limbs and the like, and with some interesting results. So Alison analyzes these photographs and others in connection with processes of identification for the viewer, specifically hysterical identification. Well, that's one of the identifications that you discuss.
Indeed, yes.
And then the next chapter discusses the work of two huge 20th century designers. I like this pairing very much. John Galliano, who was the head designer at Dior for something like 15 years, I think, until he had a sort of Mel Gibson moment.
He had a fairly spectacular fall from grace, unfortunately,
yes.
Which led to him being, he was under the influence of drink and drugs and was filmed in a bar in making some rather off-color remarks. He was making anti-Semitic, racist, sexist comments, and he lost his job when the footage of this behavior came to light. He's recently been appointed creative director of Martin Margiela. But he was out in the wilderness for a number of years as a result of his unfortunate outburst.
Right, it was pretty spectacular, and I don't think it was even the first time, but it was, this, like you said, it was caught on video, and it was, anyway. So, and then the other designer you talk about is, of course, Alexander McQueen, who's very provocative.
Of course.
We can't have a book on fashion without talking. So,
Alexander McQueen, absolutely.
He tragically killed himself in 2010, but he was at Givenchy for a while, and he was, of course, he had his own line. And well, we'll discuss. But you pair them together. Maybe you can talk about why. But they do sort of different things with desire and feminine jouissance. So
when the different models of femininity became apparent, and it became apparent to me that they mirror the different models of femininity that are suggested in psychoanalysis, specifically Lacanian psychoanalysis, then it became apparent to me that it was a logical pairing to put the two together as a way of exploring the different models of femininity available in Lacan's schema of gender.
Mm-hmm. Yes, and it was, it made sense intuitively for me, but then when you, we'll talk about it as we go through the chapters and we talk about it in more detail, but it was, yes, and it was very convincing what you were saying about their modeling the two different types of femininity that do very different things, that do different kinds of cultural work, perhaps, or psychic work. So then the next chapter is about Lee Bowery, who was kind of a fearless performance artist and fashion icon, experimented a lot with gender, died of AIDS in the mid-90s. So you explore the concept of transgressive jouissance in his work and his on his body even. So, and I'm so glad you wrote about him because I feel, you know, of course, to the cognoscenti, he's an icon, but I don't think people... I think he should be studied more. I think you even point this out in the chapter. Like, why is there not there more? Is, yeah.
There is very little about Lee Bowery. And if anybody out there listening decides that they want to write about him, then please do, because not enough people are giving him the consideration he deserves.
Yes, yes. And, you know, if for those of you who haven't seen him perform, or have, you know, never saw him perform, you might know him from actually the Lucian Freud paintings. He was immortalized by Lucian Freud.
Indeed, yes.
Yeah. So, okay, and finally, the hero of the fourth chapter is Hussein Chalayan, whom I think is the great, he's just the greatest living designer and very cerebral. I think, I'm just going to declare it right now, very, very conceptual. I frankly, I don't know what he's doing. I think he's at Puma now. I don't even know what he's doing anymore. But just a little while ago, he was doing very exciting things. And, you know, he had a few diffusion lines and ready-to-wear lines, I think, over the years, but they were never financially really successful. But his works
wasn't a businessman, unfortunately. So a lot of the time when he tried to operate under the terms of the fashion industry, he wasn't terribly successful. But his work, his concept, his ideas are absolutely epoch-defining, world-class, whatever else you want to say about them. As a creative visionary, I think he's absolutely fantastic.
Yeah, and they're very a lot of them are barely wearable, the really creative and amazing things. But if you're curious and you don't know Chalayan, you out there, listeners, you should Google coffee table skirt or some coffee table dress, maybe.
Yes,
where you see in a model convert a coffee table into a skirt. Maybe Allison, maybe you'll tell us more about that. But so you basically you use his designs and as a way of talking, or you put them into dialogue with the concept of Lacan's concept of the centum.
Okay. Yes, indeed. What was interesting about that final chapter, the chronology of my book tends to follow the chronology of Lacan's thought. So I kind of cherry pick key ideas, which is identification, desire, and language. And I then take from Lacan, and I take these ideas and I put them in dialogue with various moments in fashion and just play about conceptually with the fashion and the psychoanalytic ideas and just see what comes up. And when I came to talk about the centum, that was very much at the end of Lacan's career, and that was when he really started rethinking ideas about language. Now, usually when people talk about fashion and language, it's a kind of semiotic approach. It's based a lot on Roland Barthes and so on and so forth. And conceptually, that gets pretty limited quite quickly. I don't think, you know, if you're talking about fashion in terms of language, what the clothes actually say, I don't think I don't think there's a vast amount of mileage in that approach personally. People explored it to some extent in the 1990s, in the 80s and 90s, but I think we've kind of reached the limits of what we can say if we think fashion is language. Well, how does fashion say certain things? But thinking about fashion in terms of the centum, I think, posits language differently, for one, which then means you can think about fashion differently. And it's not necessarily about what fashion says, but about how language is constructed and gaps and elisions and relations to between language and the body and all these sorts of things that Lacan explores through the centum. And we see that very much in the work of Chalayan.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Yeah, we'll talk more about it as we just sort of get into that chapter more. I remember those years when it was all about the big question was, is fashion a language? And it was sort of inspired in part by BART fashion system. And yeah, and there was some good argument, and some people, like, maybe it's a code. It's not a language, it's a code. Because it doesn't have, you can't really narrate with fashion. Or that was the argument, or there's no sequentiality the way there is. But all of these discussions, they didn't pay enough attention to the body and the way that the body is brought into language. This is what you want to get at, right?
Yeah, language is not the system that's independent of the human subject. You know, as any Lacanian will tell you, language is very much a part of the human subject. Language, you know, the unconscious is structured like language. The unconscious is not language. That's the crucial point there. So if you're going to talk about language, you're talking about people. And you're talking about the body, and you're talking about the unconscious, and you're talking about all these sorts of things. And that's why the kind of psychoanalytic approach to language, I found, lended itself perhaps more readily to the idea of fashion as a language rather than a classic kind of structuralist approach, which negates the idea of the human subject. And of course, the other thing that's key throughout my work is the issue of femininity and the place of the feminine. And you can't really talk about that when you're talking about more structuralist approaches to language, whereas in psychoanalysis, it's this huge, big flag that you just can't ignore, and that's why it was important to me to take that particular approach.
You say that fashion defaults to the feminine, and I'm very curious about that and how you've defined fashion. But well, actually, maybe we can start like sort of in, I kind of go back a little bit and start with. How you maybe tell us a little bit about yourself and how what inspired you to bring this together, fashion and psychoanalysis, because it is it's sort of rare to have somebody who's an expert in both writing about it. So it's very exciting. So please tell us.
The genesis, the background, the kind of elevator pitch on how I got to write the book. My first degree is in English, and I encountered psychoanalysis as a part of my undergraduate curriculum. The one thing we know about psychoanalysis is that it all goes in. So as an undergraduate, I didn't understand a word of it, but clearly something went in, it stayed in there, it fermented away, and then a number of years later, when I came to put together a PhD proposal, psychoanalysis emerged from the swamp of conscious and presented itself as a critical framework that I wanted to work within. The fashion side of things is interesting. Practical side of it, you know, obviously everybody wants to do something original, everybody wants to produce original work, and no one's working on fashion psychoanalysis. There are only three books on fashion and psychoanalysis ever written in English, ever, and mine's one of them. Right. The other two were by men, and they were published in 1930 and 1953, respectively. So it's very much a niche field. Just a bit dated, yeah, absolutely. Flugel and Edmund Bergler have some quite interesting ideas, not necessarily very helpful. So obviously I wanted to do something fairly original, so fashion kind of presented itself in that respect. But more importantly, I think it's important that, you know, your work, it has to come from, if you're going to do it well, if you're going to be committed to something, if you're going to work on something really diligently for a number of years, then it needs to come from the heart as much as anything else.
Yeah.
And that's really where the fashion thing comes from. I don't come from a particularly wealthy family. I was brought up in the northeast of England, for your American listeners, kind of the British version of Detroit, where I'm from. And my mum went to work when I was a child, and when she went to work, she left me with my grandmother, my maternal grandmother, who was always very well turned out. She didn't have a wardrobe full of Dior and Saint Laurent and all the rest of it. But what money she had, she very thoughtfully and carefully put together a selection of items that she could mix and match. So she always had a very well turned out, very put together look. And going out with my grandma when I was little was a massive deal, because she had to have the right hat and the right handbag, and she had a little dog and he had a little collar with a matching lead and all that sort of thing. And she served the children's lunches in a primary school. She wasn't, a well-to-do lady. But I learned from a very early age watching her that there was something about being a woman and the presentation of the self that was, the two were very much combined. To be a woman meant to be very mindful of the presentation of yourself, to care about the presentation of yourself, to invest thought and care into the presentation of yourself. The investment of money wasn't an issue because we didn't have any, but thought and care and creativity and putting together the best presentation of yourself that you can then take out of the house and present to the world. I learned from a very, very early age that that was an integral part of being a woman. And it's like when I told us, it all goes in. So when I came to do my PhD proposal and then to do my book, all of these ideas started coming back out again. So that's how come I ended up doing fashion psychoanalysis.
So you talk about fashion here as a feminine pursuit and very much a feminine, identified with the feminine. I was curious what you'd have to say, because especially as you're talking about your grandmother and I'm listening to the story, it reminds me a lot actually of my grandfather and why I became interested in clothes and fashion. And he was a bit of a dandy, and he was a tailor. Not by profession, okay, but by his, because that's what he liked to do. It was for fun. At any rate, I'm curious what you'd have to say about the dandy, because it was at least in its initial kind of emergence, it was definitely a masculine pursuit, but it was one that paid a lot of attention to, of course, clothes and self presentation, and also. Obviously at the heart of fashion, I mean, this is the sort of paradoxical part of it too, is the fashion auteur, right? The designer. And that celebrity designer thing didn't happen until the early 20th century, but part of it, and this kind of, it's still around today, this kind of concept of, the genius designer behind all of the work, the couture, we have it in Project Runway, right? This myth, this fiction that is maintained that the designer from the very, sews everything and does it all from beginning to end. It's fully his. Anyway, so this image of this romantic notion of the artist genius alone at work, et cetera, with no production team, with no people in sweatshops, et cetera, divorced from that dirty process or commerce. This image is very masculine. And to me, so it's interesting that at the heart of this feminine kind of identified, I mean, it's clear that it is, because obviously women's, just concretely, like women's wear, there's so much more money in women's wear than men's wear, right? Or something. But still, it is still, and everybody in your book, now that I'm talking about it, is, I think you don't really discuss, or maybe as a side conversation, but you focus on men. And maybe that's on my part naive, because obviously some of these men are in a way identified with the feminine position. But anyway, I'm curious.
One of the things that I say very early on in the book is that when fashion first became associated with femininity in the mid-19th century, for a variety of social and cultural reasons, These have been discussed by Charles Baudelaire in The Painter of Modern Life. We see it in the sociologist Thorstein Veblen, the psychologist Jason Flugel. All of these people identify the moment when fashion became associated with the feminine. Now, at that point in time, the feminine pretty much exclusively meant women. But in terms of Lacanian psychoanalysis, which is my thing, the feminine is not just about women. In fact, the feminine has no kind of anatomical or biological resonances whatsoever. It's to do with the structure of the unconscious, which is why it's perfectly possible for both men and women to occupy a feminine position. Indeed, it is possible for men and women to occupy a masculine position. So I do take on board the idea that, but there are men involved. What about the men? And it's like, well, yes, but it's not just, the feminine is not just about women.
Right.
Feminine is about a particular psychic positioning, if you will, and it's a way of being. It's a way of modelling a particular form of subjectivity. Mm-hmm. It's a way of relating to language. It's all of these things within. It's an impossible and contradictory logic. Whereas Slavoj Žižek called the masculine stupid. He wouldn't say that about the feminine. You couldn't possibly say that about men. You can't say men are stupid, you know. But you can say about a particular model of masculinity that, yes, absolutely it is. Whereas the feminine offers the possibility of contradictory, paradoxical logic, and so on. So when... The observation that I'm dealing with, that I talk a lot about men, is absolutely a valid one. But my answer to that is that I'm actually talking about, to be fair, it's not even gender, because gender is an Anglo-American term. In terms of French theory, we have sex subjectivity, which isn't quite the same as gender, and this is one of the problems I had in translating between French and English.
Yes.
You know, the concepts in French, the language we have available in English to talk about them, and the concepts that that language embodies in English sometimes doesn't quite get the nuances of the French. So I've tried to make it clear in my book that I'm not talking about men and women, I'm talking about masculine and feminine psychic positioning and what they actually mean. But this does come up, and I do think that I'm probably going to have to, in my next book, make it a lot clearer, because you're not the first person to ask me about this, and I think it's a very valid question.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I understand exactly what you mean, because I was asking you more about, yes, there are these crude questions like, look, they're men versus they're, the people you talk about are men. But there's also this kind of like masculine construction versus cultural construction versus like the gender aspect, which is like the dandy, is a kind of masculine figure, or at least was, again, in the early 19th century, very, very much defined himself by his clothes, or with clothes and with appearance. So what do you do with these figures? But I think you're arguing in a more psychic plane. So
I was in New York, and I was at a conference. And after I'd been to the conference, I took the opportunity to do a bit of sightseeing. And I went to the Ralph Lauren flagship store in Soho in New York.
Mm-hmm.
And there is research that's recently been published that says that if men feel in any way that their masculinity is being questioned or impugned while they are trying to buy clothes, then they will stop the shopping experience, they'll leave the shop, they won't buy anything. So to take an interest, I can't remember the name of the researcher, I don't have it at hand, but this has just been published. It's research from America. And when I was in the States, I went to Ralph Lauren store in New York, and to make men feel happier about buying clothes, pink polo shirts and such like, they had in the shop, a Jeep. They had a Triumph motorbike.
Right.
They had canoes suspended from the ceiling and several Stratocaster electric guitars hung on the wall. To reassure men that buying a pink polo shirt or a baseball cap or whatever it is that they're buying was, in fact, the first and last word in authentic American masculinity.
Perfect, yes.
So yeah. All of these questions about, men and women, masculinity, femininity, there is a massive question there. I use psychoanalysis in my book as a way of negotiating it, but we still don't really have any big answers to this. It's still ongoing, as my trip to the Ralph Lauren shop amply demonstrated, mm-hmm. I think.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and the other thing that I found interesting relating to that is that, you know, you talk a lot about fashion's subversive potential, if you will, or disruptive. But this development of associating fashion with the feminine, at least in the cultural realm, it's very much like you pointed out in the book, it's a 19th century development, very much linked to the ascendancy of the bourgeoisie, right? The gender regime that accompanied it, and this kind of connection of consumption with the feminine, and production with the masculine. So it's interesting when masculine forms of consumption are always kind of, like you said, it's very tricky. You have to really lay it on, connected to activities, various activities, often. And so hence the motorcycle and the whatever else was there, the Jeep, etc. Anyway.
Yes.
Maybe we just say a few words about how you actually define fashion. Because readers of the book might be surprised to learn that a lot of the fashion you talk about is either in photographs or in museums or like one-off designs. So how do you kind of... They're not, in other words, like apparel. It's not about street style. It's not the kind of fashion you talk about. Is the stuff, frankly, of museums and of
You look at it and you think, well, you can't wear that.
Exactly. It's closer. It's closer. It's on the artistic
respects,
tip.
I think that's what makes it fashion. The fact that it's everyone wears clothing.
Mm-hmm.
We all there is the idea of dress codes and so on and so forth, either formal or informal. But we have dress, we have costume history, we have clothing, we have all these sorts of things. We have apparel, as you say. But then we have fashion. And arguably all of these things are synonyms for each other, but none of them are quite exact enough to exactly replace fashion. And the way I talk about fashion, I see fashion as creativity in dress, basically. I think it's important to remove fashion from the fashion industry. I think we can talk about literature without once talking about publishing.
Mm-hmm.
We can talk about, we can go to art, and we can go to a museum, and you and I could stand in front of a painting and have a long and detailed conversation about that painting without once mentioning how much it cost, which auction house sold it, the marketing involved in it, and so on and so forth. So we can have these conversations about literature and art and music and film to an extent, but for some reason, the only way people talk about fashion is as an industry. I tend to buck the trend on that one. I refuse to consider fashion as an industry. I consider fashion as a creative form.
Mm-hmm.
And I define fashion as creativity in dress. Now, this is mainly clothing, but it's also footwear, headgear, jewelry, makeup, and so on and so forth. So it's creativity, it's creativity in dress, it's the adornment of the body, and that's how I define fashion, certainly for the purposes of my book. I know it's not the only definition of fashion that there is, but that's how I think about it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I wonder, as you're talking about this, why we have such a hard time talking about fashion as art. Is, I mean, do you think it's to do with the way that, let's say, Fashion Week even works? Because it's kind of conflicted about what it is. On the one hand, it's very much an industry event. On the other hand, mm-hmm. There are some shows that are like art installations, right? It's partly the confusion within fashion itself, I think, that causes us to confuse art.
I may be giving too much away here because this is actually the subject of my next book.
go for it.
A little teaser there, a little plug. Mm-hmm. But yeah, my sense is that fashion is the only cultural form that defaults to the feminine. Therefore, and because we live in a world where the feminine is seen as subsidiary to the masculine, it's seen as problematic, it's illogical, it's all sorts of, you know, difficult things. The feminine is not seen as a positive contributing mm-hmm. force within our culture. The feminine is problematic. It's difficult, particularly at the level of the psyche and as well as the level of culture. And because fashion is associated with the feminine, it's the only cultural form that is. And because fashion is associated with the feminine, the only way we can give it any sort of legitimacy, give it any sort of value, is to frame it within capitalist discourses, to mm-hmm. frame it as an industry, because if we foreground it as a cultural form, then we're foregrounding, we're giving femininity an authentic voice, and that's something that a patriarchal society really can't accommodate. So that's my theory on why fashion is predominantly seen as an industry rather than as a creative form, whereas we can talk about art and literature and all the rest of it quite happily without talking about them as an industry.
That's really interesting. Yeah, and I think, in an interesting way, even though it's tied to, quote, industry, I think we're also tying it, when we talk about it, we tie it to reproduction. So in a sense...
Yeah,
you know, it goes into this feminine realm, and it keeps it. Yeah, okay. Apart from the genius designer image or something.
Yes. Well, we mm-hmm. have the idea of a genius writer, don't we? You know, the poor copy editor slaving away, putting in apostrophes and taking out commas is largely ignored.
True.
I'm the poor assistant that works for Damien Hirst or Tracy Emin or any of these other great big, you know, artistic names. They don't slave away in the studio by themselves. They've got a squad of people working for them, producing the work. So I don't think fashion is unique in that. What is interesting is that we... You know, fashion is one of the things where people seem to like the idea of the industry, whereas with art and literature and all the rest of it, it's given the end product, so to speak, has some sort of inherent aesthetic, artistic value that means that the modes of production can be largely ignored, whereas fashion isn't given that, isn't a privilege.
Right. Yes, and in connection, maybe this is a good segue into the fashion photography chapter, because maybe we'll see. But if not, whatever. we're just gonna move on into it because we don't want to run out of time.
Let's press on.
Let's press on. So maybe you can tell us actually about what fashion. You know, now that you've told us what fashion is in the book, what is fashion photography? Because you point out, and this is so true, that a lot of people actually don't quite know what it is, sort of lay people, if you will. I mean, they think it's advertising, etc. And so you sort of define fashion photography, and you set people straight about that. And then you talk about the kind of identifications and subjectivities, I suppose one could say, that it inspires. So please tell us a little bit about that.
Right, yeah. Fashion photography, I think, is one of the more interesting forms of photography. That's one of the more interesting genres of photography that are in existence at the moment. what's interesting is that in many respects, it's like porn. No one can really tell you what it is, but they all know it when they see it. So it's very difficult to define. But I think that's okay. You know, I don't think we, you know, if we start trying to nail things down and, you know, ring fence something by putting a definition around it, then we're then excluding other possibilities. We're narrowing down creative possibilities and the way that creative processes can develop and so on and so forth. So I'm quite happy to live without a definition.
Okay.
And fashion photography. It isn't advertising. You do get people, you know, who hold up a fashion advert and say, this fashion is like, no, it's not, it's an advert.
Right. We can talk about advertising,
but that's different and we have a different relationship with advertising. Fashion photography isn't trying to sell us something. Advertising is. That's fundamental difference between the two. Fashion photography is really interesting because it's one of the creative forms that actually women are invited to identify with. There was one of the books I read which said fashion photography is a world that largely excludes men. Not necessarily, but I do think masculine is conspicuous by its absence a lot of the time.
Mm-hmm.
And what's interesting, of course, is that fashion photography has seemed to be this awful force. You know, if you open a magazine and you look at fashion photography, then you will develop an eating disorder and you'll become profoundly mentally ill because fashion has this, it can act by some kind of osmosis on the poor female brain.
Mm-hmm.
Of course, that's not what happens at all. That's a load of nonsense. But yeah, fashion photography, it's really interesting. With its emphasis on the body, it doesn't really show clothes. If you want to see what clothes look like, go and hang out in the working class suburbs, you know, in New York, go to Harlem or something. In London, you'd go down to South London or Hackney or somewhere like that, see what the kids are wearing. And that's where you'll find, you know, the latest fashion that's going to be picked up.
Mm-hmm.
Fashion photography isn't necessarily about photographing clothes. It's about creating an image of the clothed body, the creatively clothed body that invites a certain type of identification, particularly an identification by a feminine subject viewing the image.
Yes, and you talk about more hysterical or discourses that are initiated or identifications that are initiated by looking at it. I was wondering if you could say more about that because it seems very radical what you're saying that actually by looking at it, in looking especially with Nick Knight's work, you start to question. You know, like, who am I, and where do I begin and end, et cetera?
Yes.
This kind of radical questioning of the subject.
Is this me, you know? Because it's, you know, we know from psychoanalysis that identification is how we constitute ourselves. We look at the world around us, and we recognize other people, and they're not me, and we see images of ourselves initially in the mirror, what like Lacan called the mirror stage, you know, when you're an infant. And every mother does this. She holds the mirror in front of the child and goes, that's you. And the child learns that that's me, and I'm separate to my mother, and I am this person, and so on and so forth. So there's a and this isn't a one-off event. This is a constant process, and it's how we as human beings relate to images. And it's why images have such a really profound effect on us as people. It's why, you know, people weep at art, you know.
Yes.
Or films or things like this. It's because you're not just looking at something completely passively and neutral. There's a process of identification there that speaks to the really deepest levels of your soul. So that's, you know, why images are important. In terms of what I say about fashion photography, I'm thrilled that you think it's radical, by the way. Thank you. That's one of the nicest compliments I've ever received. Thank you very much for saying I'm radical. There's a popular idea that hysterical is a bad thing, that if you're hysterical, you're out of control and there's something wrong with you and all the rest of it. When really, conceptually speaking, hysteria is resistance, is feminine resistance to the strictures placed on it by a masculine-dominated patriarchal system. So hysterical resistance is just women's way of saying, no, I am not being that woman. I am not being that person that you have set up for me. I do not fit that space that you have created for me. I will resist you pushing me into that space. And that happens at the level of the unconscious. And this results in what in the 19th century was identified as hysteria. And all it is feminine psychic resistance to the positioning of femininity.
Mm-hmm.
Relational to... Sorry, go on.
No, I'm sorry to interrupt. I was interested, and we kind of have to sort of start moving on, but from this chapter, unfortunately, because mm-hmm. I was curious. I remember it was a very complex argument, and I don't want to simplify it by summarizing it. But you actually describe the ways that the photography actually invites that kind of questioning.
Yes, it does. Mm-hmm. And this is one of the. Things about if you're going to go with my argument that fashion is feminine, fashion as a cultural form defaults to the feminine, then fashion photography invites a feminine questioning in a way that more masculine visual culture probably doesn't.
Mm-hmm.
That here closes the nutshell, so to speak.
Okay. Yes. So it's interesting. So you move from the mirror stage in chapter one to desire and feminine jouissance, or feminine sexual positioning in chapter two with McQueen and Galliano. And you start the chapter, I just want to read this quote. I thought it was a provocative, in some ways, beginning to the chapter. So this is Galliano speaking now. I want people to forget about their electricity bills, their jobs, everything. It's fantasy time. My goal is really very simple. When a man looks at a woman wearing one of my dresses, I would like him basically to be saying to himself, I want to fuck her. I just think every woman deserves to be desired. Is that really asking too much? So that's the quote. And when I read it, I have to say, I thought, well, Galliano's no wordsmith. Like, he's a genius designer maybe, but I thought it was a little bit of a cliche. But then you did so much with this quote, actually, and you really took it in some very interesting directions. So I guess, you know, you say that fashion functions for Galliano as the cause of desire, as he put it in that quote, but you give it a Lacanian spin. So it functions as object A, or it can also symbolize and this is even more fascinating, you can represent the feminine within the symbolic, like let's say like a garment in a museum. Alexander McQueen appearing, that it's sort of like, here it is, it's representing the unrepresentable, perhaps. So please explain this. This is, you know, really interesting.
Yes, this comes from Lacan's idea that nothing can be said of woman. Mm-hmm. It's impossible for the feminine to appear directly in the symbolic order. So my argument then is that, well, how then can the feminine appear in the symbolic order? Because clearly it does. It just doesn't appear directly. And one of the ideas that I came up with when I was thinking about this was the idea that fashion is woman's ambassador.
Uh-huh.
in the symbolic. So fashion appears because the feminine cannot, by reason of its structuring, appear directly in language. So fashion acts as, cannot appear in language, cannot appear in the symbolic. So fashion acts as woman's ambassador.
Mm-hmm.
So that was the essential kind of point that I was trying to make with regards to Galeano. But of course, we know that that's not the only model of femininity that there is. There are other models of femininity. And Alexander McQueen presents the other model. And Alexander McQueen presents not objet art, who, you know, the object of masculine desire. What Alexander McQueen presents is feminine jouissance, which is rapacious, it's destructive, it's terrifying, it's the Valkyries, it's Medea, it's Medusa, it's all of these things. And that's what feminine jouissance is, and that's independent of the masculine in and the symbolic order. And generally speaking, feminine jouissance is, it doesn't appear in the symbolic, it can't appear in the symbolic, but what Alexander McQueen does is create a space where it can be expressed. Where it, Suzanne Barnard said, you know, it can be traced in the history of its effects. And, you know, we kind of see that in Queen's work. So what's interesting is if we compare the Galeano quote that you just gave, where he thinks that women should be absolutely thrilled if a man wants to fuck her, because mm-hmm. having a man's penis in you is the ultimate accolade. It determines your worth and your value as a woman, and it's something that we should all aspire to and be incredibly flattered when we're on the receiving end of it. But then Alexander McQueen says something a bit different. Alexander McQueen says that he wants women wearing his clothes to be so fabulous you wouldn't dare lay a hand on her.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the key. They're the two models of feminine sexuality and feminine. You have feminine jouissance and masculine jouissance in objet art. And Galeano is desperately obedient to the social order and to the symbolic and all the rest of it. Alexander McQueen realizes that actually at the level of the psyche there's a lot more to it than that, and he manages to articulate this in his work, and that's what makes McQueen so unique. That I don't think we'll see his like again. No one else kind of had worked that out up until McQueen, and I don't think anybody else will.
I agree. I think at least right now it's not really imaginable. But actually, so it's interesting, this kind of reaction where, how did you put it? The woman looks so fabulous that you wouldn't dare
so
go near her.
You wouldn't dare lay a hand on her.
Right. But it's also something, there's a kind of repulsion attraction, this kind of like something scary, something untouchable, but it compelling at the same time. This is something that Lee Bowery also did. But arguably,
indeed,
in a more sort of gross out, if you will. Well, maybe.
Yes.
I mean, but it was thrilling.
No, that's fair comment. Yeah,
but it was also thrilling in a certain way. So it was something repulsive and thrilling, and maybe this is maybe you can elaborate this effect that the through his performances had on viewers.
Yes, Lee Bowery, he died the year that I moved to London, so I never got to see him perform live. So all I have are friends' stories and various photographs, and there are some videos on YouTube of his performances and so on. So there are he still has a presence, thanks to the digital age.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, Lee Bowery, he dealt with, a lot of his performances were very visceral. But when he did performance art, a lot of his performances were very visceral. They relied on references, a lot of it was very scatological. He gave himself enemas on stage. He once gave birth, in inverted commas. He came on stage with his wife, Nicola Bowery. She was under his costume, and then he lay on. He sang "All You Need Is Love" by the Beatles, and then gave birth to his wife. So it was. There was a lot of. It was all very corporeal. It was all very visceral, and so on. So his performances, particularly towards the end of his life, were about the idea of the body and its limits and what it's capable of. And that may or may not be related to the fact that he was HIV positive, and he then died of AIDS, tragically. So it's conceivable that that may have been a motivation for some of his performance work. But in terms of his fashion, he was, what was interesting about Bowery was, he made all his own clothes. He didn't make clothes for anyone else. He designed and made all of his own clothes. And on the back of the clothes he wore, he became famous. You could do this in London, in Soho, in the 80s. But Lee Bowery became famous on the back of the clothes that he designed and made and wore himself. And what's interesting about that is he said that all of the usual ideas about gender and fashion are completely irrelevant. He's going to completely ignore them. And he said this back in 1986 or something. I've got a quote from his diary in my book where he actually said, you know, men's and women's fashion absolutely stinks. And we shouldn't, you know, base our idea of dress on gender. And then he would tuck his genitals to give himself a flat-fronted appearance around his pelvic area. He was fairly corpulent, so he would tape his chest fat together to give himself the impression of breasts. He would wear weird shoes. He'd wear a big pom-pom so you couldn't see his head. And normally you identify people's gender by their face. That's the first thing you look at, you know. And so he'd wear it. He'd mask his face in some way, mask his whole head in some way. So that, you know, all of the usual signifiers of gender that we usually use to navigate our way through the social world, they just didn't exist in Lee Bowery's fashion.
Right. I mean, one importantly, he wasn't trying to convince anybody he was a woman, in other words.
No.
Right, exactly.
No,
yeah.
No. It was that he wasn't trying to pass as anything. What he was doing was saying that actually this passing business is nonsense. Why do we need to have the binary gender divide where men are masculine, women are feminine, and never the twain shall meet? Bowery threw all of that out the window.
Mm-hmm. What do you think he's saying, or Lee Bowery does for Lacanian theory? Because I think at one point you might have said something about queering Lacan through Lee Bowery, kind of, or at least through, by thinking about Lee Bowery, we can think about queering Lacan, and I was wondering if you could elaborate a little bit on that.
Yes, and I must confess, in terms of my initial formulation of this chapter, I do owe a massive debt of gratitude to Tim Dean, who wrote On Sexuality, and Tim Dean argues in On Sexuality that in Lacan's formulation, the feminine and the masculine have absolutely not are psychic constructions, and that's all they are, and they have very little to do with any sort of sex subjectivity or anything to do with socially constructed notions of gender. Because normally so there's the biological reality, and then there is the
right.
There's the biological reality, but then there is also the kind of cultural construction. The biological reality is your sex, and the cultural construction is your gender, male, female, masculine, feminine. And if we take a psychoanalytic model of sexuation, of how we understand masculine and feminine, we realize that actually it's got nothing to do with either anatomy or culture, that it all happens at the level of the unconscious. And then from that, we can start to talk about agenda in very in really quite interesting ways. Tim Dean was said that in his book on sexuality. I worked with some of his ideas and used them to elaborate my thinking on Lacan and Lee Bowery's work.
Mm-hmm. So yeah, this is not your Butler, Judith Butler, Butlerian notion of gender as performatively elaborated. I mean, her argument also has been caricatured a lot, I have to say. But anyway, yeah, this is not about cultural construction. And I think that even I've, in this interview, fallen a little bit into this trap where it's hard because it's so dominant, you know, within the American context, right, not to sort of think about the mass.
Same in the UK.
Mm-hmm.
Same in the UK. It's very much the Anglo-American tradition.
Right.
So when I went off and started working with French theory, a whole vista of other intellectual possibilities opened up.
Definitely. Okay, so, my gosh, we're going to run out of time soon. But before we do, do you want to say something about the chapter 4, about Chalayan and his work and how it's expressive of this, of the Santom?
Sure, yeah. As I said, much of the book follows the chronology of Lacan's thought. So the final chapter of my book is the final chapter of Lacan's thinking, which was when he came up with the idea of the Santom. In many respects, this chapter was quite difficult because Lacan, depending on who you talk to, either contradicts himself when he develops his idea of the Santom, or he develops a completely new way of thinking. I'm not going to take a position on that because that's not my project here. But it's an interesting approach because the Santom it's not quite the symptom, but it appears in language. And it's what, for Lacan, unites the three realms of the imaginary, the symbolic, and the real. And so the Santom is this kind of free-floating phenomenon in language that unites the three separate realms of the unconscious, if you will. So the Santom is interesting because it does that, and it does this in language. So when you start talking about saying Chalayan's work in these sorts of terms, then it allows you to link language to the body, which in Lacan is the real, and also the visual, which is the imaginary. So it's that's essentially what happens in that particular chapter.
Mm-hmm. Is there something specific about Chalayan's work rather than another designer, another maybe conceptual designer, or you just thought he was like a good example of what you were aiming for?
Chalayan lends himself particularly well to the ideas that I was exploring in that chapter.
Okay.
By definition, you have to kind of cherry pick who you're going to talk about and going to miss out, and that's just the nature of the game when you have to, you know, you're writing to a word limit and so on and so forth. There's no shortage of other designers that I could conceivably have looked at. But Chalayan, at the time when I was conducting that research, was the designer that I felt was best suited to the ideas that I wanted to discuss, which is why I chose him.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so we're almost out of time, and I wanted to ask to give you another opportunity to maybe to talk about do you have a title for your next book? Is it, how close is it? Is it, you know?
Oh, it's not remotely close. Books are never close because they don't write themselves, unfortunately.
So I don't
need to actually find it, which is tragic. I wish they did, but I need to find time to press on and write up the manuscript. It will be ready for, it'll probably be out in 18 months to 2 years' time, so 2017 ballpark. Mm-hmm. I expect it to hit the shelves. But at the moment, I really can't say any more than that. I've got the ideas. I've got the bones sketched out. But now I need to just put the shoulder to the wheel, so to speak, and get the thing written.
Yeah, that was not intended to be any kind of pressure, but I was curious. So that was not the question. But I was curious about it. It seems like it's about fashion too, right? The second book.
Yes, it is.
And the feminine. Mm-hmm.
Yes, fashion. What I'm doing is, in many respects, I'm taking some of the ideas from my first book and making it more explicitly political, because my first book is, as you said, there's meaty chapters, it's highly conceptual and all the rest of it, which means that unless you have a very strong knowledge of psychoanalysis, there's a limit to how much use you can make of the ideas in the book. What my second book is doing is hopefully going to make, it's going to be a bit more accessible, for one, and also a bit more politically relevant as well. I think hopefully it'll be more accessible to a wider audience.
Mm-hmm.
Because
okay,
it'll still have
course. I can assign your book.
You can, absolutely. And I will happily give a guest lecture on Skype to your students if you would like me to.
That's fabulous. If I ever have a chance to do, I taught fashion history for a number of years, and but there was a dearth of, I signed a lot from anthro and sociology and art history, of course. And I wanted to do something more, but then there was so little. And that was right. And I stopped teaching it as your book came out, Fashion and Psychoanalysis came out. So anyway, I am very excited.
Thank you.
Thank you. So, we're wrapping up now, and it's been really a lot of fun talking to you. You've written a really fascinating and much needed book. Again, we've been speaking with Alison Bancroft about fashion and psychoanalysis. Thank you for joining us, Alison, and thanks to our
audience. It's been a pleasure. Thank you very much.
Thanks, and thanks to our audience for listening. Till next time.